good afternoon, everyone. Joining us in the foxhole today, we have two guests. Raymond C. Niles is a senior fellow and columnist at the American Institute for Economic Research and a university professor. He has contributed book chapters to In Pursuit of Wealth, The Moral Case for Finance, and he recently published, and the recently published book, Coronavirus and Economic Crisis, edited by Peter Earle and published by the American Institute for Economic Research. And joining Ray is Kyle Kirschling. Kyle is an urbanist who specializes in improving cities' infrastructure. He's a licensed CPA and holds a master's degree in urban planning from Columbia University. And today our topic is going to be substeading. Gentlemen, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Great, pleasure to be here.
All right, I think most people are maybe familiar with the term seasteading, which is floating cities. What is substeading?
Well, the words are similar, but they're really quite different concepts. Seasteading is a proposal to build basically a new country with political sovereignty by developing platforms out in the ocean, which would be separate from any sort of governmental jurisdiction. What we're talking about is actually more similar to an earlier concept called homesteading, which we could talk about in a little more detail later on.
Please
but
do.
The idea behind substeading is to establish a legal structure for people to claim the unused commons underneath cities, underneath the ground, in order to put them to productive use. So the idea is that there's a wasteland underneath cities, unused space, and that if someone has a proposal to put it to productive use, for example, by building a new subway line, a new road, a new electric utility or internet conduit, they make a proposal to do that, and under the standardized procedures of a Substead Act that would legalize this, the government, the city or state, whichever jurisdiction it is, would recognize their legal title to that property that they created, which means they could buy it, they could sell it, they could lease it, they could do what they want with it, and they could earn whatever profits they're able to make with it. And the idea is that this would encourage the development of this underground infrastructure and create new valuable transportation projects in particular.
All right. Now, the Homestead Act, wasn't that something like 40 acres and a mule?
Yeah,
is that much more elaborate than that?
Yeah, that was a basic idea. So, the United States, after the Louisiana Purchase, right, we bought that vast Midwestern region.
Right.
It was largely a wasteland, leaving aside issues of tribal jurisdiction, but it was largely unused space. And the idea was to put it to productive use. But to enable this to happen, they needed enabling legislation, which was the Homestead Act of 1862. And there were other Homestead Acts as well. And it basically said, you can claim a piece of land. I don't know if it's 40 acres or 150 acres or, some quantity of land. And if you agree to make it productive, it becomes yours. So after, farm it for 5 years, the government would recognize that you've established legal title to the land and that you get it as of right. It becomes your property. It's actually based on the idea, going back to the philosopher John Locke, who said that the root of property is when you put you add your productive labor to a resource, right? And it allowed the whole Midwest to flourish and the whole area to get farmed and become productive, and for America to become a breadbasket, to the world, which is what we are.
Right. Now, in your paper, you claim substeading is a legal technology, quote unquote, that will unleash entrepreneurs. Can you delve into that, what the legal technology means?
Sure, and if Kyle wants to chime in on that as well. But we're proposing a Substead Act. So there needs to be new legislation to create a set of standard procedures that people can follow if they want to lay claim to the commons to make it productive. So there are details on how it would work, and I'd let Kyle chime in with maybe a little bit, some of the details.
Sure, and I guess I'll just point out that this is, in a sense, an expansion of government. As we were talking before we started recording, this is a problem that's never really been solved. It's, a lot of the problems we have today, we just need to repeal laws and get the government out of the way. But this is really an area where we've not really had properly established property rights underground. Now, they've had it for mineral rights in certain applications, but not really ever in cities in a way that could be useful for utilities or transportation or that kind of a thing. So this is a new, like, it is a legal technology. It's something new. And, you know, there are, it could work in different ways, but it might be something like where essentially just creating a process whereby you decide you want to build something underground and you first make sure that you know, by doing surveys or looking through records to see if that space is available, there's nothing there, there's nothing physically in the way. And then you would file a claim with the government saying, we want to build a tunnel here, or we want to build a, you know, extend our basement here or something like that. And they would perhaps do their own title search to make sure it's available. And then you'd have, say, 5 years to build that thing. And then once you finish building it, you go back to the government and say, okay, we built it. And then you would get the government say, okay, it looks good, and stamp your title. And now it's yours fully and clearly, or full and clear. I'm not sure what's the right phrase, but it's yours. You own it. It's your property now.
Okay. All right.
You've improved it within a certain amount of time, because otherwise you could file claims and you could tie up land forever. So you need to kind of have some sort of time limit.
Sure, sure. Now, in the green room, I mentioned that my neighborhood was, our utilities are underground. And I think it was, Ray, that you said that New York City, by law, was like that. Is that correct?
Yes. New York City utilities are underground. And you're talking, you said that the electricity is reliable where you live for that mm-hmm. reason. And it's absolutely true in Manhattan. We rarely have blackouts. Usually it's some external cause outside, you know, apart from the grid. But I think the story we were talking about, which is very interesting and points to the need for a Substead Act to establish clear property rights, you can go all the way back to Thomas Edison when he sought to lay down the first commercial electric grid in the world. Everything was great. He could buy the land for the generating plant. But the problem was he needed a network of wires to go out to all the various homes. And those wires had to travel underneath the streets. And no one owned the streets. In fact, the only way he could get access to them, he had to basically beg for permission from the political officials. They liked that, especially back in those days, because they asked for huge bribes to dig up the streets. And it took a whole year to negotiate those bribes just for New York to get the electric grid. And even it delayed America from having the first commercial electric grid in the world. We were like the second country to get it because of the need to negotiate those bribes. This is what happens with underground development of any infrastructure today. Anywhere it occurs today, it's an ad hoc, politicized process. It involves corruption of some form. You know, it might be money, direct cash, or it's campaign contributions. You know, quote-unquote campaign contributions, giving children of the political officials jobs, things like that. And the idea of a Substead Act is to make this development as of right so that you can do this without being involved in this expensive, slow, bureaucratic, politicized process.
Okay. We had the same same problems with the subway. We didn't get the first subway didn't open until 1904, and New York City was already the second biggest city in the world by then. We had elevated transit because the property rights were clear. You could own it, but underground, it wasn't. No one was going to invest because they didn't have the certainty. Or about 15 years ago, an investor proposed building a tunnel connecting Long Island to Connecticut under the Long Island Sound. And it wasn't even corruption. It was just that nobody even really knew who would be responsible for approving it.
I remember that, actually.
Yeah.
Remember that. Now, in your white paper, which I'll call it a white paper, is a report, I guess, one or the other. But you include a diagram of a proposal from Singapore. Was that ever finished or begun, or do you know?
Yeah. So the diagram itself was from a news item reporting on it, and it just shows some of the potential for different things that you could do underground, things that they were exploring in Singapore, like power substations and, you know, sewer systems. And they even showed like an ammunition facility to, you know, store ammunition and explosives. Now, that is actually a planning effort that's being led by the government, and it's ongoing, but it's mainly to illustrate that they do sort of see that the point there is that it is a wasteland, that we're sitting on this sort of wasteland underground, that there's not really much there, but there could be. Like, there's a lot of potential to use it. And they actually did passed some legislation to try to straighten up the property rights a bit. That apparently one of the reasons the government was interested in this is because they wanted to, you know, they're building infrastructure underground and they didn't want to have to keep buying up all the property on the surface. They wanted to try to separate it into different stratum underground. So there is some, you know, consideration of property rights, like pretty much like to define how deep people own basements and things like that. But it's a government-led effort. But the main point of it is to show that they're trying to explore the potential, let's do the practical potential of using underground space for things.
So, Kyle, I see with your bio, you have been very focused on how the trains are then going on time and how to decrease time. And, you know, time is money. And here in Europe, and especially like in Gothenburg, Sweden, it's a huge project, infrastructure project that we are doing tunnels and other things like that. But right now, the whole city is upside down, you could say. So it's hard with the regular traffic to do something, and it's already now delayed, and the costs are skyrocketing. And here also in Gothenburg, it's a coast city, so it's built on clay, you could say. How will you take that into account so it's safe, so to speak? I mean, I see this is very interesting to from A to B, instead of, you know, all the traffic and hassle and so on going underground, if it's safe and you're not, you know, afraid to be in a, like in a capsule underground. It could be both, you know, good, but the safety things, how do you think about that?
Yeah, there's different aspects. There's, one is, you know, getting the public to feel comfortable and feel safe and want to ride on it so they, you know, that they're not worried about it being collapsed or flooding or that kind of thing, which would certainly be important and I think was an issue with the early subways. And I guess the actual safety concerns, so then there's, I guess we could say another category would be protecting the buildings and things that are, that you're building underneath and around. And that would be, so, you know, I sort of described what the Subset Act might work, how you would subset a piece of property, but the, in terms of protecting other property, that would, I think, probably happen through the courts. And certainly, if you're going to build something underground, that you do have a, you know, a right to that support that you're getting from the ground. If someone's going to build underneath you, you still have a right to that support. Like today, there is a, it's called a right of adjacent support. So if you build a building right next to another building, if you have a lot right next to the building, you can't just dig your foundations deep, you know, you can't just dig a big hole there because the building next to you would collapse. So it's not like a, so there would be certain right, something like that, some kind of concept that would require you to ensure that it doesn't move. And I think they would have every incentive to make sure that it doesn't, because if it is moving, it that would probably mean there's something wrong with the, you know, integrity of the structure itself. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of answer your question?
Yes, please. Yeah.
And I might just chime in on that a little bit. You know, the profit motive is the best protection of safety. It's the same reason McDonald's doesn't want to give you poison hamburgers, because guess what? They'll lose all their customers. I mean, anyone building a building today, I don't think the issues are any different than building, you know, they're different in detail, but not in principle than building anything today above ground or other projects. You know, you're going to need insurance. You're not going to be able to get insurance if you're not using properly trained engineers. You're going to need to get bank financing. No bank's going to give you a loan unless the project makes sense. You're not going to get other investors unless the project makes sense. And then, you know, where there are issues, which, because it is, you know, there will be, the other thing to realize is underground development, this isn't new. I mean, it's happening all the time. There are tunnels being dug underneath London right now, under New York City right now. And, you know, but this would increase the quantity of it because it would unleash a lot more private capital. But where there are issues, I agree with what Kyle said. That's what the courts are for. But it'd be just like any other property infringement issue. You know, the courts would rule. They'd say there are damages. They'd award damages. And, you know, the insurance companies generally would be the ones on the hook for it.
Yeah, my great fear for this idea is the bloated bureaucracy and the human-hating environmentalists will stifle every proposal for this kind of thing to go forward. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's, you know, the case has to be made for this act to be passed, right?
The Subsetting Act, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this is why we wrote this paper. We really believe in this. You know, we want to see our cities be better places to live. And I think, you know, Kyle will probably talk more about that at some point on this podcast. But, you know, but the act does need to be passed and people need to be convinced. And if it's passed, you know, the development will be, there'll be a streamlined as of right procedure for it to happen. And that'll waylay the ability of environmentalists and other people to criticize. It'll waylay them from doing it. And the second thing is that the development is underground. So there are literally no issues of blocking views or, you know, blocking the paths of migratory birds or, you know, whatever issues someone can dream up. They will dream up issues. But I think if we could get the momentum to get this act passed and then to see it work in practice somewhere in the world, it doesn't have to be New York, it could be Singapore, it could be Gothenburg, it could be anywhere, maybe with the backing of someone like Elon Musk, I think that we will win. I don't think the environmentalists will be able to stop it.
I mean, it is a concern, but I think we have a number of advantages. In fact, that's one reason why we're doing this, because we think that you could apply this homesteading to above ground and all kinds of things, but underground is a great place to start. And some advantages we have now is just we have Rand and her ideas, like, so we can give a proper defense of it. The moral defense, you know, like that's a big game changer in a lot of ways.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
I mean, and another advantage that we have is that, especially in like area of mass transit and certain and roads where the government controls it, people kind of know that it's not really being well managed. So I think it'd be a little bit more, you know what I mean? It's a little more open than 100 years ago when people were looking at, you know, these, the railroads and how they're corrupt. And now it's, you know, we can point to the government and say, well, it's clearly their problem. And at this point, since it's still very early, we're just trying, our focus is to try to get, you know, a number of people, like the right people, excited about it. And then that's what Ray and I will do, is if we get the criticisms, which we hope we get lots of criticisms, so we can fight them off and defend this idea.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Well, again, emphasize to our audience that what you call the totality of private sector monies in building this, no government interference or tax burden on the public. I mean, as you said, Ray, profit loss is the best incentive.
Yeah. So we're trying to, I mean, in some ways, what we're trying to do is create a free market underground. It's not a public private partnership. And at this point, we're not even trying to privatize existing government infrastructure or divest existing infrastructure. We have this blank slate. And, you know, obviously it gets very tricky trying to create a free market zone or to try to increase the role of the private sector in infrastructure, which is something I'm personally want to do. But this is a way of doing it just physically, rather than saying, well, you know, in the roads, well, the cars are private, but the roads are government. You know, there's such a mixture. But this is really, we want it to be a private sort of utopia underground that's really important. I mean, it's sort of like we're saying no one's using it. So that's part of the bargain, in a sense, if you want to think of it that way, that look, this stuff that's going to get built, it's private. There's nothing there. And if the private companies weren't allowed to build it, there wouldn't be anything there now. So they should be able to charge whatever they want with it, and get all the benefits from whatever they build underground.
Yeah. And it's all additive, right? Like, you know, really what Kyle's saying, it's all additive. There's nothing, there's only a potential for gain here. And the second thing is, the idea is it's just it's establishing a private property right, but, you know, all the capital at risk would be private. And you know, the other virtue of that is that the profit motive means that the kind of projects that would get developed would have the greatest opportunity to benefit the most people. Because that way, you know, that's how you'd make your money. It might begin with small projects, but, you know, there would be projects that would really add value. You would not have, you know, with a private profit motive, you would not be building tunnels to nowhere. Now, if you did build a tunnel to nowhere, you know, like a road to nowhere, a bridge to nowhere, which the government does all the time. Like, there's that famous bridge in Alaska that I think Senator Stevens from Alaska wanted built to connect this airport. Literally, no one drives on it at all, and it cost a pile of money. If that happens, the only money that's at risk is the investor's money. the taxpayers are not on the hook. So that gives an incentive to have better projects. And if there are failures, and there will be failures, but they're going to be failures on a much smaller scale than we see where government, with its unlimited ability to tax people, you know, and we have huge disasters when the government fails with projects.
Yeah, let me quote right from your article. And it's, quote, if these new projects replace planned government-funded projects, then subsidizing has the potential to reduce taxes, unquote. I think every citizen likes the sound of that.
Yes. Yeah, and you wouldn't be paying taxes for things that you're not using.
True.
Unless
true.
You're using it.
Yeah, and also over time, you know, what would happen over time, I mean, you know, these private projects would outcompete the inefficiently run government projects. That would also be a factor. So, you know, we don't really talk about it so much in the report, but, you know, eventually, like, for example, in New York, let's say someone builds a new subway line, and it's just cleaner, it's cheaper, it's faster than the government-run subway line, people will be using that private line, and they'll be drawn away from that public subway line. And actually, I think down the road, then, there will be privatization of these subsidized government operations, and that would reduce taxes.
Yeah, and then it might be a while before you can start to shut them down totally, but certainly there would be less expansion going on, and the capital investment in a lot of these public projects is enormous. So that might be one of the ways where you first start to really save money, where you can reduce taxes.
Kyle, let me ask you this. The history of the New York subway, wasn't it privately funded to begin with, or I don't honestly know myself?
Sort of. It was so we had elevated trains before. These were steam-powered, coal-fired locomotives running over the streets from beginning in the late 1870s. And it was an enormous network of there was Rapid Transit Act of 1875, which sort of created it was part of what, you know, inspired me, that a process, like an objective process, a somewhat as-of-right process. There were some problems with it, but it was, you could build a structure over the street and own it, and it would be yours. And it wasn't until 1904 that the first subway opened. I think it's sort of a long story. Let me try to just give it briefly. The elevateds were 10 cents, and it was a bit of a luxury service. It was more like a commuter railroad, a nice service. And they realized that they could actually make more money because they had spent this enormous capital investment building this huge, you know, system of the structures, you know, all over the city. And they were struggling to make money. They experimented with lowering the fare, cutting it to 5 cents, hoping that they could generate enough business that they could really get the use out of this huge structure that they had built and make more money. And it took a few years, but they were able to do that in order to maximize profits. And that's when sort of rapid transit became the backbone of the city's transportation system before. And it was the surface transit, the streetcars and things that most people used or walked. But lowering the price had a big impact on the city. And so then the city was like, okay, now, but we really need more subways. We should start building things underground. But we also love this 5 cent fare. So of course, if it's a good thing, you make it mandatory, right? And they came up with a beautiful design. Unfortunately, it wouldn't pay at 5 cents. So it took a long time to get anything going. The city had to change things around in order to subsidize it and pay for the part of the initial capital investment. But it was a design, build, operate, maintain, if in sort of like the current nomenclature for public-private partnerships. It was they had a 35-year concession to, and they built it, operated, maintained it. They collected the fares, and then they were paying off the city's bonds and also paying taxes and rent on the space that they were using underground. So it was a rather private system, but it was the city had kind of come up with the initial designs, and it was using the city's credit to help make it pay at 5 cents.
Okay.
I might just add one quick thing about this story, which illustrates how important true property rights are for the developers of the underground infrastructure. So what happened, this 5 cent fare, you know, like Kyle said, it becomes mandatory. Well, then what happened was World War I, and we had massive inflation during World War I because we went off the gold standard. So that 5 cent fare effectively in real purchasing power became like a 2.5 cent fare, and the subways couldn't operate with that. And So they stopped, they had all kinds of expansion plans they were going to do later on. They stopped that. And eventually the city stuck to that rule, 5-cent fare, even while inflation was picking up. And they basically bankrupted the private subway operators. And then the city took them over around 1940, around that time.
Yep.
And then guess what the city did? They raised the fare to 10 cents, of course, mm-hmm. now that they're operating the subway system. But the idea is that an operator to attract the most capital, right? Investors will only be interested if they have the ability to charge whatever fare the market will pay, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they can earn whatever profits that they're able to achieve by providing great service. But when this, the city came in, they made it a political issue, and they basically, destroyed the financial basis for the private subway system to operate.
So they were, and these private operators were very clever and very efficient. One of the big problems, though, was that it wasn't an open system. It wasn't open to competition. You had to get a franchise, a franchise that was awarded by the government. So that would be a big disadvantage to that system. Even though, okay, what you get is more efficient than if the government were to operate it directly, but you're not going to get innovation in design and new lines added, and that. That was always a problem.
Yeah. Let me just add real quick on that point about franchise, because we mentioned it in our report. True property rights means you have an indefinite, you can own it forever, right?
Right.
Now, when you don't have it, when it's a franchise system, it's a terrible system. So a really bad example of that was in Chicago, and they would only award 5-year franchises to anyone using the streets. It could be electric utility operators, it could be streetcar operators. And think about it, if you're building out an electric grid or a streetcar system, that infrastructure is very expensive. It needs to be financed with multi-decade long bonds. This has an economic life measured in decades.
Mm-hmm.
If at the end of 5 years, the government could basically just shut it all down, right? What do you have to do? You have to have a big suitcase with a lot of cash in it that you have to hand to them every 5 years. So the Chicago City Council loved this, and they were even the nickname for them. They were called the Gray Wolves. Gray because they're old men, and wolves because they voraciously suck the life out of anyone using the streets. That's what we want to avoid. If you have that kind of system, you're not going to get the kind of development that a city needs to flourish.
Who can forget Mayor Daley and his gang? Anyway, that's a little bit of history. So, we've covered some really good things and some possible great things. Now, one of the things I want to mention, when I've seen like unique homes and things like that on these home shows, if you will, and some of them like they're built inside in the side of a mountain or something, and it's the temperature in the house is like idyllic, so it doesn't freeze, and you're not in a sauna either. It's like this idyllic thing. And would that be some of the advantages of going underground?
Yeah, it would be for some applications. There are like data centers and things like that need to be a certain temperature.
Absolutely, yes.
More efficient to do that. There are, in fact, there are mines that have been turned into office parks, for instance, in a few areas. I know there's one in Kansas, and so it's this underground office park. And I think,
wow.
Yeah, I think it's called Sub City or something. And I think that's a big draw, is being able to use this space for things that need to be a certain temperature. Now, of course, it's not necessarily going to be comfortable because of all the equipment, generating heat. So you might have to manage that.
Okay.
And then once you start going deep enough, it does start to get warmer sooner than I would have thought. And it gets, once you get a few miles down, it starts to get pretty hot, actually.
Okay.
you don't want to touch the magma and cause.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what they'll say. Okay, you're going to cause a volcano, right?
That wouldn't be good. No. What I'd like to do, to wrap up, gentlemen, give us or paint us a picture of like an idyllic underground situation, shopping malls, hyperloops. What do you think?
Well, let me try my expertise is mainly in transportation, and one of the big values of transportation, maybe the biggest really, is speed. Like, as you said before, time is money. And I mean, and the transportation system that we have today isn't really that much different than 50 years ago. It would be totally recognizable. In fact, I went out to Yosemite a few years ago and drove a 28 or 29 Ford Model A.
Oh my.
And it was, now a Model T isn't as comparable, but a Model A, you can use regular gas, the same gas, the same roads, and it has basically the same performance capability as a modern car. You could use it as a regular driver, not a Model T, but a Model A. I mean, mm-hmm. And that's almost 100 years old. And I think, you know, with trains, it's very recognizable. We have air conditioning and things like that, but it's, we're overdue for, you know, a leapfrog ahead in technology. And, you know, and even travel times haven't really gotten that much faster. I don't think jets have gotten that much faster in the last 50 years either.
No, I think you're right.
And if you imagine, if you could get anywhere, like just say your town, for instance, your city, if you could get anywhere in half the time, if it took you half as long to get the places that you frequent, like just imagine how that could change your life. It's not so much that you would save time in getting there, but now you could go to twice as many places, right? So you could go to that restaurant that you like a little bit better, like the food that they offer, it's a little bit better. You could go there now. You can see your doctor or dentist who, you know, you think you prefer better. You can go to a different school that maybe before seemed, well, out of reach. You can apply for a job that's better matched to your skills. I mean, and you can find a romantic partner that's a little bit better. You can put more zip codes, you know, in your search and your dating app and find someone who's a little bit better matched to you. Like these are the kinds of things that can happen if we can make just by making transportation faster.
I'll give you my example. I live in New Britain, but my work is 60 miles from here.
Okay.
So I drive, it takes 75 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like 120 miles round trip. Yeah. Now, if I could cut that 75 and not only cut it in half, but not even not drive, just get on a train or a Hyperloop or something, that would,
Wow. The quality, right. I mean, cause what we're talking about is creating completely new rights of way underground. So this would allow completely new transportation technologies. It's not like a road where you have to have some kind of vehicle on it. Like this would be completely novel systems. You know, like that it's independent of what we have today. So it could be radically better and not just faster, but like as you suggest, more convenient and more comfortable and be autonomous or things like that, which would just make it a much more pleasant experience.
We want to unleash human ingenuity, you know, that entrepreneurial ingenuity, but that requires property rights and it requires the profit motive, and that just doesn't exist right now. So,
well, the mind is the greatest resource, I believe one or two people have said in the past. Well, this has been great, gentlemen. I really appreciate that you guys taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. My pleasure.
And Blair, Kai, and Ray, I have a thing like could be become a cliffhanger and also follow-up.
Yeah.
But I see what you could do with this future scenario is that you could listen to the Secular Foxhole, and then I will quote you here on section Conclusion, the Future Now, page 31. In your building's central lobby, there are pods, P-O-D-S, leaving every few minutes. And that's, you know, the word iPod and podcast. So you could sit here in the pod, listen to a podcast, and then have a nice journey and be productive and get inspiration and so on. And also at the end, like, could you tell a little bit, like a cliffhanger, so we could do a follow-up, how you met? And also, you know, the funding here that we have talked about, this thing that you could support creators like with streaming friction parts of Bitcoin like Satoshis. I see that this kind of project with private enterprises could be that you could fund it directly with people and individuals and others that want to support it and get, you know, a part of it. So I see a great potential in the future. So please, Kyle and Ray, if you could tell a little bit about how you met and then we could plan for a future follow-up.
Okay, but we won't say too much, right? Because we want to give them a reason to come back.
Yeah, wonderful.
And as I recall, I was introduced by my coach, life coach, Jean Maroney, who is doing really amazing and groundbreaking work in psychology that has been just personally, transformative and it definitely helped me to, in a lot of ways, because I have a full-time job and I need to work on this paper on the side. And that's a real challenge of motivation to spend, half an hour a day, an hour a day working on it. So, but she knew Ray and suggested that we meet. And I don't think that she knew just how much we would hit it off, but we had sort of independently come up with this idea of underground homesteading. And I was interested in transportation and looking at some of the efforts to reform the MTA, which is the government agency that runs transit in New York City. And I was thinking, well, would be there a way to just let the private sector do things if they want to at least have some way to get to allow competition without affecting other things? And Ray's expertise, is in the electric utility industry. And he can, tell you about that.
Yeah, I'm also an economist. I have a PhD from George Mason University, which is the leading free market economics university in the world, if I might say so. And I have an MBA and I worked on Wall Street for a long time. So, this is the kind of idea that will appeal to Wall Street, right? I mean, if the Substed Act gets enacted, there will be investors.
Oh, yeah.
Because
sure.
What the worst thing for investing is legal uncertainty. This is why people don't want to invest, say, in dictatorships in Africa or South America, where you don't know if you're going to keep your property. But unfortunately, we have the same problem in the United States when you have to operate under political franchises or whatnot. So Kyle and I definitely did hit it off. We had a lot of very enjoyable lunches where we discussed this and we wrote this, and I know we're going to be doing other great things together. But I think we want to see this happen in the real world, and it can happen. And I think if we could get this, for example, into the hands of a visionary like Elon Musk with his Hyperloop technology, or a real estate developer, someone who owns a lot of property that wants to create an efficient way to connect it to the central transportation hubs, I think this idea will happen. I think, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of political effort to do these one-off ad hoc large-scale developments. Like here in New York City, there's a big development called Hudson Yards. It required the whole support of the mayor Bloomberg to get behind it for it to happen. Otherwise, it never would have happened. This would not take any more effort than that. But once it's created, you have a system to unleash multiple projects, not just one at a time. So, anyways, I went a little over what.
Amen. No, that's. I'm glad you said that.
It's fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to Ray Niles and Kyle Kirschling today. Gentlemen, thanks for manning the foxhole with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.